Okay, just a few logistical points. I have your assignments. They're marked. I'll hand them back during the break, and we'll take up the assignments. I'll post the solutions to it. They were well done. I think the average was 8 out of 10. Your midterms were marking. I had another class, so I marked the midterms for that class, and then I'll get started on marking them this week. So you'll get them back next week during class, and I'll take them up as well. Okay, so it's been a while. Is there any questions since last class? Okay. Yeah, it is still. Any other questions? Okay, so we'll, let's just sort of roll into it a little slowly. So just to get sort of caught up, let's consider a scenario. All right, so here's Alice, here's Bob. Alice is going to send a secret message. Okay, if everyone can quiet down, please. All right, so let's say that Alice has some ID number. Think of it as her student ID, and she's going to send this encryption to Bob, okay? And we have an adversary, and the adversary is on the wire. Okay? And so the adversary is able to capture this particular value of C, okay? And we say that encryption's, you know, it's secure as long as he can't decrypt it, okay? So the adversary doesn't know K, he can't decrypt it, then that's fine, okay? Then we started looking at a different notion of security, which we called CPA secure, and we said, okay, let's assume that the adversary, they still don't know the key, okay? So they can't decrypt it, but what if they had access to Alice's computer? Like, say Alice goes away for lunch and the adversary sits down at Alice's computer and they can ask for the encryption of anything they want. Okay? Okay? So they still can't decrypt this ID. Okay, that's what they want to do. They still don't know the key. Giving them access to the encryption of whatever they want doesn't let them figure out what the key is. Okay? But what they could do is they could sit down and they could try, you know, ID equal to 0000, and they'll get encryption of it. Then they could try ID equal 001, 002, 003. They could try all the different IDs, and eventually it might be the case that one of the encryptions returns the exact value that they observed. Okay, and if that happens, then they've effectively broken the crypto system, even though they didn't break it in the traditional means, which is by recovering the key. Okay, now this only works, this attack only works if encryption is deterministic, meaning when you encrypt the same message twice, you always get the same answer. Okay, so the easiest way to make it so that the encryption scheme is secure, even if the adversary is able to do this, is by making a randomized encryption, okay? And so that's what CPA security is meant to capture. It's meant to capture the idea that you get access to the encryption of anything you want, and therefore the only things that are going to pass this higher level of security are things that are going to be randomized, okay? Okay, now the second thing that maybe the adversary could do is imagine if when they sat down at the computer, not only would it encrypt anything they wanted, but it would decrypt it as well. Okay, it wouldn't give them access to the key, but it could just say, here, go ahead and decrypt this particular value. Okay, now in this case, they can always, their goal is to try and figure out what your identifier is. So they can always just submit C and ask for a decryption of it, and then they'll learn what your ID is. Okay. So that's not that useful of a notation. Basically, as soon as you give someone a decryption oracle, no crypto system is going to be secure against that, okay? Because you can just ask. Being able to ask for the decryption of anything you want is no different than knowing the key. It doesn't matter if you know the key because you're using the key to decrypt whatever you want anyways, okay? But what we might do is we might change the game slightly and say, okay, you can ask for the decryption of anything you want, but you can't ask for this exact value of C. Okay? So as long as it's not this exact value of C, you can ask for anything else, and you'll get a decryption for it, and that's fine. Can you learn what this ID is? Okay? Now, because of the avalanche effect, we know that as soon as you start changing a few bits of C, if you ask for the decryption of it, you're going to get a completely random looking thing. Okay? It's not going to get you any closer to finding out what the ID is. Okay? But we also know from last class at the very end that some of these block ciphers have these malleability problems where you don't know what ID is, but you could change this encryption in such a way that you know what the consequences would be if you decrypt it. So imagine this was a stream cipher, okay? What you could do is flip the first bit of the identifier, flip the first bit of C, so it's no longer the same value. You could ask for a decryption of it, and then when you get your plain text back, you would just flip the first bit of the plain text, and now you have an actual decryption of C, even though you never asked for a decryption of C. Okay? So this idea of non-malleability combined with the ability to ask for the decryption of anything you want leads to a big problem. Okay? So where we're going with this is things are CPA secure. That's fine. CPA secure requires randomization. There's a higher level of security we call CCA. CCA stands for chosen ciphertext attack. So it captures this notion that you can choose any ciphertext you want and it will decrypt it for you. And the only way to get CCA security is you can have no malleability at all. As soon as you have malleability, you can break the CCA game, just like if you don't have randomization, you can break the CPA game. Okay? And that will be like the final highest level of security that you can get from an encryption function. Okay? So let me summarize as a kind of roadmap where we're going, and then we'll walk through the actual details of what's going on. So we looked at three levels of security. So we looked at OTS, we looked at CPA, and we're going to look at CCA. And in terms of a requirement, for CPA, we need randomized or non-deterministic encryption. And for CCA, we need what we call non-malleability, meaning there are no malleability attacks. Okay, and we'll talk about how we achieve that in a second. Okay? And then we looked at some different types of encryption. Okay, so on the block cipher side, we looked at ECB mode. ECB mode is OTS secure. We looked at CBC mode. CBC mode is randomized. Which is necessary for it to be CPA secure. Not sufficient. You have to prove a little more about it, but it does happen to be CPA secure. We looked at counter mode, which is CPA secure. Counter mode, we noted, is a stream cipher. Okay, it's just a stream cipher that uses the block cipher to generate random numbers for you. So since it's CPA secure, any stream cipher will be as well. Okay, and then here, what we're going to do is we're going to find out that it's actually really hard to get this level of security. The CCA security, it's not enough to have a really good encryption function. What we need is we need something else. We need a way of sort of signing data so that if there's any change to it, you'll be able to tell that there is a difference, okay? If we have that, then we can unlock CCA security, okay? So what we're gonna do is we're gonna do a CPA secure encryption. And we're going to add something to it called a MAC. Okay, we'll talk about MACs a little later, which stands for Message Authentication Code. Okay, if you have that, then you can get CCA secure. Okay, and there is a mode of operation that I'll just talk a little bit about. I won't go into the details because it's very complicated. You can do your project on it if you want. It's called GCM or Galois counter mode, and it's the most common CCA secure encryption scheme that you'll see. Like on the web today, you can see it actually in use. Okay, so this is sort of a roadmap of where we're going. Now let's remind ourselves of the CPA game. Any questions so far? All right, so you all know the CPA game now, right? So we can off by heart.
Well, it's after the midterm.
Yeah, it's after the midterm. You've studied for other courses and you forgot everything. And it was on your cheat sheet anyways. So you actually memorized it. Okay, so basically what we have is we have two parties. We call them an adversary and an oracle. And the adversary is trying to prove that they can break the encryption scheme to the oracle. And the oracle is kind of like challenging them, saying, I don't think you can break it, so let's set up this little game. I'm going to give you a challenge. And if you can really break it, then you'll be able to win this challenge some amount of time. Okay. So the first thing the oracle does is they choose a key. We'll say the key's L bits. It's chosen randomly from the set of all L bit keys. So that's just heavy math notation to mean you pick a random key. Okay, it's probably 128 bits, whatever the case may be. Now in the CPA game, as opposed to the OTS game, what we do is once you pick the key, the adversary can send any message they want. And they'll receive an encryption of that message under key K. Okay, so this is sort of like when you leave your computer and you leave it sitting open and someone can sit down and just ask for the encryption of any message, it's meant to model that aspect. Okay, then the actual challenge part of the game, the actual like sort of game within this bigger setup, is what the adversary is going to do is they're going to choose two messages, call them challenge messages. We can call them M0, M1, such that M1 is not equal to M0. It doesn't even matter. I mean, you'll never win the game with better than a random chance if you choose the same message twice, but we'll just denote it this way. Okay, so you send these two messages. Then what does the oracle do? So the oracle is going to flip a coin. So they're going to choose randomly between 0 or 1, which you can think of as heads or tails. And then they're going to send back CB, where CB is the encryption under K of MB, where MB is either M0 or M1, depending on what the flip of the coin was. Okay? So they're going to send either the encryption of this or the encryption of this, and they're going to say, if you're so smart you can break encryption, you'll know which one I sent you. Okay? And if you don't know, the best you can do is guess. And so either you're guessing and you're going to win 50% of the time, or you actually know something and you're going to win 50% plus some amount that's non-negligible. Okay, then what you can do is after you've chosen these ciphertexts, if you want, you can repeat this step. So you can go back to asking for the encryption of whatever you want. Okay, so the key thing that you would ask for is, once you've set what M0 is, you would ask for an encryption of M0, right? And you could ask for an encryption of M1, and one of the two will match CB if it's deterministic, okay? Then you'll know you'll always win the game. So that's why no deterministic encryption scheme will ever win this game, or will ever be secure according to this game, okay? But if it's non-deterministic, then you can ask for M0 and you'll get back a completely different C. Then you can ask for M0 again and you'll get another different C, and you can sit there all day and ask for M0s one after another, a million of them, and you'll get a million different Cs, and none of them will match the C that you were given here, even if that was an encryption of M0. Okay? That's the idea of randomization. And remember, the randomization factor is big. Okay? It's like a 128-bit value. That means for the encryption of any message, like say M0, there's 2 to the 128 possible encryptions of that value. And every time you ask for an encryption, it just picks one at random. So the chances of it ever repeating are negligible. Okay, it won't. So you're never going to win the game by asking for it a lot of times. Okay? Then at the very end, you you send your guess. And then you get back, you know, accept or reject, or right or wrong, whatever, however you want to phrase it. I'll just put true or false. So call this B prime. Does B prime equal B? Exactly, exactly. So what does it mean to be secure? So we might say, well, in order to be secure, you can never win the game. Well, that's clearly not right, because even if you guess at random, you're going to be right half the time, right? Okay, so what does it mean to actually win the game? First off, what does it imply if you win the game? If you win the game, that implies you've broken the encryption scheme, okay? So win implies not CPA secure. That's the implication of winning. And winning, your percentage it has to be equal to 1/2 plus some amount. So 1/2 plus epsilon is actually what it has to be more than that. So let's phrase it as it needs to be strictly greater than 1/2 plus epsilon, okay? What's epsilon? Epsilon is just your luck factor. So let's say you play the game once and you win on the first time. Okay, that's not absurd, right? You have a 50-50 shot of winning the first time. Well, what's your winning percentage? 100%, right? And so you won 100% of the time. Well, that's a lot more than winning a half, okay? So what epsilon says, you can just think of it as play this game 100 times, and then show me that you can win more than, you know, 50% plus or minus some small amount, okay? Or play 1,000 times. That amount is going to go down. It's going to converge on 50% really, really quickly the more often you play the game if you're just winning by luck alone, okay? You can't get that lucky. So that's all that this means, okay? So it's just a small technicality that exists just to deal with that particular case. Okay, questions about this? So this is the CPA game. So OTS is everything except for purple, and it's the same as well. You always win by a half plus epsilon, more than a half, yeah.
If I win the game 1,000 times,
yeah.
So I'm confused. How the value of epsilon goes to zero?
So what goes to zero is the term here. So forget about this. So you have 1/2 plus some luck factor that you're going to win, okay? That luck factor is going to go to zero. Or in other words, your probability is going to go closer and closer to a half, okay? What epsilon represents is an upper bound on how lucky you can get. So you can only get so lucky. And so it's going to be 1/1 a polynomial in the number of times that you play the game. There's a very strict mathematical definition of it. It doesn't matter for this course. I'm not testing you on the theory of it. It's just think of it as that corner case where you just get lucky. It's going to rule that out. That's the only level of understanding you need. Yeah.
So all random I have all randomness. So my chance is
so your chance is always going to be a half because you where does the 2 come from? So a half is 1/2. Why is it 1/2, not 1/4, 1/8, or whatever the case be? It's because there's 2 messages here, right? Or the coin flip has 2 outcomes, either heads or tails. Yeah. So at the end of the game, you're guessing, was the coin a head or a tails, right? And so if you don't know anything, then you can always play that game and guess 50% of the time. Yeah. So you can think of this if it helps. Let's say I said, what's the percentage of let's say I go and flip a coin in secret and you don't see it. And I say, what's the percentage that you're going to win that? Right? It's going to be 50%, but you have some luck factor, right? So, right? So that's, it would be 1/2 plus epsilon. So this is the number that describes how lucky you would be at guessing coin flips if you didn't see what the outcome was. Okay? So here what we're doing is we're flipping a coin, and then we're doing some encryption action based on whether it's heads or tails. So if it's heads, we're doing one thing, we're encrypting one message. If it's tails, we're encrypting the other message, okay? So now you have some information about which of the two we did, okay? So you could do better than a random guess, but it would require that encryption to actually leak some information about what you actually did, okay? And if it doesn't, then you're just guessing what the coin flip was. Okay, any other questions? Okay. All right. So now what we want to do is we noted that in both CBC mode and encounter mode, there's these malleability issues, okay? So in encounter mode, if you flip a bit, what happens? Well, the corresponding bit of the plaintext flips, okay? But the rest of it remains the same. So you can still tell a lot about the information. In CBC mode, if you flip a bit, then it's going to destroy the entire block that you're working on. But in the next block, it's going to flip that corresponding block. Another thing you could do in CBC is So in CBC mode, if you flip one bit, it's going to destroy this block plus flip the next bit. Another thing you could do is flip a bit of the IV. So remember, the ciphertext and the IV go across the wire, and the IV is in plain text. So if you flip a bit of the IV, what it will do is it will flip that corresponding bit in the first block, and then that's it as well. So that's another malleability attack you could do. The high-up level point is when you go flipping bits, you kind of know what the consequences are. It doesn't, like, completely ruin everything, okay? What we want in the CCA game is we want an encryption scheme where if you flip even one bit, it completely ruins everything, okay? Or even better yet, it just fails to decrypt. Imagine it would just throw an error and be like, that's not a valid ciphertext, okay? Then it wouldn't decrypt at all. And if your ability to flip get bits and actually find a valid ciphertext was really, really small, like you could sit there trying ciphertext all day, making up ciphertext, and you would never even find a valid one, okay? Then that would be like the ultimate, okay? And that's actually what a CCA secure encryption scheme is. But we're getting ahead of ourselves. Okay, so the, yeah?
If you have the valid and invalid, ciphertext,
yeah.
Doesn't that reduce the possible ciphertext that you can?
Yeah, great question. So I'll give you a short answer in words and then I'll draw it. Basically, remember when we added an IV, when we added randomized encryption, we have the same problem, which is now there's a million encryptions of one message. So it sounds like you can encrypt a million less possible messages, but what we did is we just increased the input space. So we have this new value, which is the IV value. We're going to play the same trick again. So we're going to introduce a new value. So now the encryption of a message will consist of an extra value that will take care of that particular problem. I don't know if that makes sense, but I'll show it to you. Okay. So CCA, just like the relationship between OTS and CPA, we have the same idea where we're going to start with the CPA game, and then we're just going to give the adversary even more power. Okay, so they're going to be allowed to do new things that they weren't able to do. So if they're able to win this game, then by definition, they're going to be able to win this next game as well, because they're only getting more powerful, okay? But the converse isn't necessarily true. So if they're not able to win this game, it doesn't say whether or not they can win the previous game. Let me try and get the whole game up. Okay, so what we have in blue is OTS. What we have in purple are the two editions of the CPA game. Okay, now we're going to give two editions for CCA. Okay, what are we going to do? Well, what we're going to do is we're going to give the adversary not only the ability to encrypt any message, but the ability to ask for the decryption of any message as well. So you can pick a CI at random, which is a ciphertext, and you can say, hey, give me the decryption of that ciphertext under key K. Okay. Then what happens is you can do, just like in the CPA game, you can do it both before and after the particular challenge ciphertext. Okay? The only caveat is after the particular challenge, you've seen the actual ciphertext challenge here, CB. Okay? So if you're able to ask for the encryption, let me start again to make this clear. Okay. After this stage, you've seen the challenge ciphertext, which is CB. If you're allowed to ask for the decryption of any C, you could just ask for the decryption of CB, and then it will tell you which M it is. Okay? So we're going to add the caveat that you can ask for the decryption on anything on Earth but CB. That's the one ciphertext you're not allowed to ask for. Okay? Otherwise, no encryption scheme would ever be CCA secure by definition alone. Okay? So we're going to be as permissive as we can to the adversary while still maintaining a definition where there is a chance that you could write down an encryption scheme that would meet it. Okay, so we'll say any CI not equal to CB. Okay, before it doesn't matter because you haven't seen what CB is anyway. So you might submit it before. If you submit it before, it's just because you got lucky and you happen to guess what CB would be. But your chances of getting lucky are 1 over 2 to the 128, which is infeasible, assuming the ciphertext is 128 bits long. Okay? Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So the key gets picked once, and the encryption, decryption key, the challenge key, and then the other phases, it's all under the same key. Okay? And then everything else stays the same. So the winning percentage is 50% plus your random factor. Okay, so why were we doing this? Well, we were doing it because we saw a bunch of malleable encryption schemes that were, you look at CBC mode, right? It's malleable, so it seems like something's broken, right? There's something about it we don't like. It seems weird that you should be able to flip bits and know what's happening in terms of the plain text, okay? Seems like encryption shouldn't allow that property. But on the flip side, we had the CPA game, which seemed like a really good definition of what security meant, and yet this thing was CPA secure, but it was also malleable. So that seemed to be a kind of contradiction, okay? So what CCA is it's an even better definition of a secure encryption scheme where any malleability you can expose, you can win the game. You can use that to win the game. Okay? So let's just see how that works. So let's start with CBC. Okay. So the assertion is CBC is not CCA secure. Okay. And specifically, we're going to use malleability to try and break it. Okay. So can anyone think of how you might break this using the malleability property? You only need these, you actually only need this, these two steps. But.
Just the beat I want to send on the ciphertext change.
Yeah.
I will send that beat on the M1 or M0 and M1 and 0. So I will get the ciphertext of that beat. And next time when I will send the MI, if I change the beat on the MI,
yeah.
So sorry, on the CI, yeah. Change the beat on the CI. So when I get the ciphertext, I will know that this bit changed and this is the
beat. Okay, good. So that sounds reasonable now. Okay, so let's, I'll do it a little more verbose than this, but that's the right idea. So what we're going to do is we're going to choose M0 and M1. And it doesn't matter how we choose them, but we want to make them look really different from each other. Okay, so let's assume that, for example, we choose M0 to be all zeros and we'll choose M1 to be all ones. Okay, the other thing we're going to do is we're going to try and get this more than one block long. Okay, so let's assume that it's like two blocks long. Okay, so we'll say, hey, Oracle, give us an encryption of one of these two. Okay, so what we'll get back instead is we'll get CB, and CB will just look like randomness, whatever. It'll be like 1001110. Okay, now we can't ask for the decryption of CB. Okay, but what we could do is we could flip a bit of CB and ask for the decryption of that. That's technically a different ciphertext. Okay, so CB we can't. Ask for a decryption of. But we could ask for the decryption of CB. Okay? And let's assume, I'll just sort of draw it over on the side here. Let's assume it picks M1. To encrypt. Okay, so this is an encryption of all ones. Okay, just to make this concrete. Okay, so what we'll do is we'll ask for the decryption of this and whatever, we'll flip this bit here. Okay, so we asked for a decryption of it. So we're going to get back MB prime, which is the decryption of CB. What will MB prime look like? Should be able to tell me exactly. Okay, so what we'll do is we'll see a first block that's like 100110, just look like random noise. Okay, and what will the second block look like? Okay, so we'll see 111. We'll see a zero where this particular flip was. Then we'll see 1111 all the way down. Okay. And based on this, was it an encryption of this or was it an encryption of this? It was an encryption of M1, obviously. Okay. And so because of that, so we'll guess. That B equals zero. Sorry, B equals one. It's an encryption of this. And we'll win 100% of the time. Okay, which is clearly more than a half plus epsilon. Okay, any questions about that? If the blocks of every which? No, it doesn't matter as long as you can distinguish it down here. So when you flip the bit, when you flip the bit here, this is going to get ruined. So as long as basically, as long as these two are different, it doesn't matter. So you could shoot yourself in the foot if you did 0000000 11100, then these will always come out looking the same. You know what I mean? So as long as there's one difference between these two, it doesn't matter. Yeah. So there's a million different ways of choosing these blocks so that you can win the game. But this is just an easy example. Yeah. 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 That's correct, yeah. So as a reminder, in CBC, yeah, so it looks, if you flip that bit of the ciphertext, it will flip that same bit in this next block. Okay, yeah. Exactly, yeah. So the one rule that we made, the modification we made, is that CI can't equal to CB. Why did we do it? Well, because no encryption scheme would be secure. You could always win the game regardless of what the encryption scheme was. Yeah. So the IV will change every time. Sorry? CCA secure, yeah, thank you. Okay, so we can do the same thing with counter mode. It basically follows exactly the same. In this case, we just can use one block. We don't have to use two. So we might set one to be all zeros. Set the other one to be all ones. We'll receive CB. We can create CB prime, and CB prime will just flip one bit. And then MB prime is going to be either, you know, 0001000000, or it's going to be 11110111111. If we see this, we're going to guess that B equals zero. If we see this, we're going to guess that B equals 1, and we'll win 100% of the time. Okay? And I promise you, for any other kind of malleability where, as long as you can flip a bit of the ciphertext and understand what will happen as a consequence, and it won't completely ruin the ciphertext, you can always do this same trick. Okay? You ask for two messages that look different. You get CB back, you flip the bit, then you get the decryption, and the decryption is going to be exactly this with whatever that transformation is, or exactly this with whatever the transformation is. Okay. Questions? All right, so I'm not going to prove that, but that's the final fact, is no malleable encryption scheme is CPA secure.
CCA.
CCA, thank you. So you can always modify CB to create CB prime. You're not just going to modify it like trivially. You're going to use whatever the malleability property is. Okay? And then you can ask for a decryption, and you'll be able to distinguish M0 and M1. Okay? Later, we're going to see like public key encryptions that are using number theory, where you could take a ciphertext, you could multiply it by two, and then when you decrypt it, it'll be the same message multiplied by two. Okay, so that's, malleability is not always about flipping bits. That's what you tend to see in block ciphers, but it could be about multiplying numbers in or that type of thing as well. Yeah. So the Oracle, every time the Oracle does an encryption, and this is by definition of CBC mode or whatever it is, they choose a new IV. So if you want to go through this game, M0, M1, you get an encryption CB. So CB will have an IV with it. I just didn't write it in. So CB will be IV and then the two ciphertext blocks. Then when you ask for the decryption, you'll get CB prime. It will have an IV. So every encryption has a fresh ID. And the key's the same. For the whole run of the protocol. Yeah. So the whole game is done under the same key. So they choose a key at the top and then that's it. Yeah. But for every encryption, you choose a fresh IV. In CBC mode. That's what the definition of CBC is. No. So every time you replay the game, it changes. So the key starts in the first, yeah, and then if you play the game again, once you guess, you shut the whole thing down, you start again, you choose a new key. Would there be any consequence to using the same key in multiple games? Probably not, but anyway, that is how it's modeled.
If the adversary can get the next
item, yep,
going to save by Oracle,
yep,
then I think you can break the CBC.
Exactly, yep, so you can break CBC, that's right, yeah. So we showed that last class. Yeah, so if you can predict what the IV is, not only can you win when you're allowed to ask for the decryption of anything, you can win even if you don't have access to this green stuff, right? Even if you just have blue and purple stuff, you can win. Yeah, so this game is, the green is what you get to do because it's CCA. The purple is what you get to do because it's CPA, and then the blue is what you get to do if it's OTS, okay? So each game is strictly stronger than each previous game. So once you're CCA secure, you're by definition also CPA secure and also OTS secure. Yeah. Yep. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. So the Oracle chooses the key at the start, and then you run through the game. You output your guess. Then if you want to play again, you start at the top, so it chooses a new key. In the CPA game, yep, and in the OTS game. Although in the OTS game, it only is allowed to use it once. That's why it's one time secure. Okay, other questions? Okay. All right, so what would we need for CCA secure? So let's say we want to do this CCA secure. What do we need? So before we answer that, let's think about just moving from OTS secure to CPA secure. So in ECB mode or any OTS secure mode, that's only OTS, that's not anything else, you have messages, and the messages are being mapped to ciphertext, okay? All right, so this message might go to this ciphertext. This message might go up to this value. Okay. And basically, the size of the message space and the size of the ciphertext space are the same. So for every message, there's a ciphertext. There's only one ciphertext. If there were two ciphertexts that map to two different locations, then you can decrypt. Okay. So the definition of decryption is that this will decrypt to a single value. Okay. So it's a bijective function if you want. And the key, what's the key doing? Well, the key is choosing this shuffle. So you can think of this as kind of like a shuffling, right? You have all the possible messages. You have all the possible ciphertexts. For any particular message, like 01100110, there's a ciphertext that's the exact same value, 01100001 or whatever. And so you can actually think of it as a shuffle or a permutation if you want. So it's a permutation of this space. And the key is basically selecting which permutation you see. Okay, so that's the key's job. So for every different key that you choose, you'll get a different shuffling of these. Okay, so that's conceptually what's happening. Sometimes block ciphers, if we're being very theoretical, we'll call them a pseudo-random permutation. And that's what that means, is we're just shuffling up the message space. Okay. Now, what we wanted for OTS, what we didn't like about OTS, rather, is that the same encrypting the same thing always gives you the same result, right? So if I ask for the encryption of this, I get this result, and if I come back later and ask for the encryption of this, I always get the same result, okay? So what we wanted for CPA security is we wanted to make it so that the output is bigger than the ciphertext, okay? So the output is now looks kind of like this, okay? So we have the ciphertext size, and we also have the IV size as well. Okay, so for every ciphertext, there's 2 to the 128 IV values. Okay, so what happens is if you ask for an encryption of this, you get some particular message here. But if you ask for it again, then you'll get some different message here. And if you ask it again, you'll get some message here. Okay, now you clearly couldn't do it in this space because you run out of values. Okay. If you run out of values, then you're saying, well, you can't encrypt every possible message. So that doesn't make any sense, okay? So what we did is we had to expand the ciphertext space in order to do it, okay? So different messages still map to different locations, but now we have more than one. The same message can map to lots of different locations, okay? That's sort of what we're looking at. Now, if we want CCA secure, this is what we're going to do. Okay, we're going to start with the same message space. And what we're going to do is we're going to make the ciphertext space even bigger. Okay, it's going to be really, really big. I know this doesn't look that much bigger, but it's going to be a lot bigger. And it's going to be the same size as your message space times IVs, because we'll still have IVs. And we're going to have some other thing. We'll call it a tag, and I'll show you what that is later. Okay? And so now what's going to happen is it's going to look a lot like up above. If you encrypt a message, you end up somewhere in your ciphertext space. If you encrypt a different message, you'll always end up somewhere different. If you encrypt the same message twice, you'll end up somewhere different. If you encrypt the same message twice, you'll end up somewhere different. Okay. Now, what's a malleability attack? Well, a malleability attack is, let's say you're here, and what you're going to do is you're going to change this ciphertext to a slightly different ciphertext. Then you're going to decrypt it, okay? And when you decrypt it, you're going to end up with a slightly different message, but then you can turn the message back into the original message, okay? So you have a message that's, if I follow these lines right. Okay, sorry. So you encrypt some message and you end up here, okay? Then you change it to some related ciphertext, and then when you decrypt it, the message that you get back is related to the ciphertext, okay? That's essentially what's going on, okay? So what we want to do to stop that attack is when you change this ciphertext to some other ciphertext, what we'd like is for that to just not decrypt anything, for it to be an invalid ciphertext. Okay, and if you change it to something else, it's going to be invalid. And you can try all its neighbors in every direction, and the chances of you finding a valid ciphertext, the valid ciphertexts are basically spread through this space so sparsely that your probability of just picking anything at random and have it actually be a valid ciphertext, let alone some meaningful ciphertext, is negligible. Okay, so you won't even be able to write down a valid ciphertext if you're just writing it down. Okay. So we have this space, and in this space, we have a whole bunch of invalid ciphertexts. Okay? Now, we have to fit everything in. So for every message, there has to be a corresponding dot here, but it's also non-deterministic. So for every message, we also need lots and lots of dots over here because there's lots of encryptions of the same thing. Plus, we need lots of dots for all the invalid stuff. Okay? So our ciphertext space is now really large, but it's not that large. So your ciphertext will be whatever size it is. Your ID is 128 bits. That gives you 2 to the 128 possible randomizations of every single message, and your tag is not going to be that big. It could be 40 bits or 60 bits, or maybe it's 128 bits. So that will give like 2 to the 128 or 2 to the 40 or 2 to the 60 of these other dots spread out throughout the system, okay? Times the number of possible valid ciphertexts, okay?
Is it possible from this space, same ciphertext could decrypt as the same two different messages?
No, so that's not a thing. You could design a function that would do that. But the problem is it would be problematic because I would send you a message, and then when you decrypt it, first off, you won't know which is the right message, right? And then if you pick one at random, yeah, half the time it will be wrong or whatever the case may be, yeah. So it just doesn't make, from a requirement standpoint, it doesn't make sense to have a decryption function that decrypts the different messages. Now, there are some exceptions to that. So some people have looked at what they call deniable encryption. So what you'll do is you'll send an encryption of a message, and what you'll do is sort of pick like two messages, and then you'll send an encryption of it. And then if someone coerces you and says, what was that message that you sent? Then you can deny it by opening it up to the other message as opposed to the message you really meant. It gets a little more complicated. That's the kind of high level view of it. But yeah, if you want to look at deniable encryption, that's a good project topic. But yeah, in general, we want encryption to just decrypt to a single value. Okay, so if this doesn't make sense to you, it doesn't really matter. This is just to try and visualize what's going on. I'm not going to test you on this page here. Okay, questions? Okay, so what we need is we need some definition of invalid ciphertext. Okay. And so we'll eventually get there through something called message authentication codes. But before we do, I want you to just forget about basically everything we just talked about. Just forget about encryption altogether, and let's just study what this primitive does in and of itself without regard to anything else, okay? So what we have is we have a problem where we have Alice, and Alice is holding a secret key. We have Bob. Bob is holding a secret key. It's the same key that Alice holds. How did they both end up with the same key? Haven't solved that problem yet. Okay? So it's just like an encryption. Okay? And Alice wants to send Bob a message. Okay? Now, we care about two properties. So if you go way back to the very first lecture, I said generally in security, you care about three things: confidentiality, integrity, availability. Okay? So encryption is a confidentiality thing. How can Alice send to Bob this message such that an adversary in the middle can't actually read what that particular message is? Okay? That's what encryption does. Okay? In this case, we're going to focus on, what about integrity, okay? So forget about confidentiality. Let's say Alice sends a message to Bob, and there is an adversary in the middle, and sure, who cares? The adversary can read that message, okay? It's not a secret. We're not trying to hide the message from the adversary. But what we'd like is, if the adversary is in the middle, not only can they read the message, but they could change it, okay? So let's say that, and let's say you really want to be sure that you didn't want the adversary to change that message. Okay, what could we do that would basically do something to this message using the fact that we both have these keys so that the adversary can't change it? Okay, that's what we want, okay? And that's what a message authentication code does for us, okay? So what a message authentication code does is it's going to produce some number, we'll call it a tag for now. It's like an encryption function. It's a tagging function. And it's going to take the message's input plus the key that both of us know. Okay? So we're going to tag this message using our key, and it's going to output some value, call it A. Okay? And we're going to send both M and A across the wire. Okay? Now, what the adversary is going to do is the adversary wants to change M. So that's fine. They can change M. They're going to change it to M prime. Okay? But what's going to happen is when Bob receives M prime,
he's going to compute the tag on M prime using K, and it should come out to a totally different value of A. Okay? And if it comes out to a totally different value of A, then he'll know that the message was changed. So why can't the adversary just change M and then change A to match it? Well, it's because it depends on the secret key. Okay, the adversary doesn't know the secret key. The adversary can try every secret key, just like in encryption. That's fine, but the key space is going to be so big, it's going to be 128 bits, and the adversary can't try 2 to the 128 bits of keys. So she takes M, changes it to M prime. She's not going to be able to compute A prime given M prime. Okay? If we had such a function, then we could solve this integrity problem. Yep. Yep, that's right. That's right. Yeah, so we don't concern ourselves with that. So you could always resend the same M and A, and then that's always fine. So we will handle, we'll care about that in the higher level protocols that we use. But at the base primitive level, we're not going to care. Okay, so what's a MAC? So a MAC, or a message authentication code, is basically that particular function. So we take a message. It can be any size, just like in encryption. We have a key. The key has to be big enough that it can't be brute forced. So it's going to be at least 112 bits, generally 128 bits. And then we have a tag, okay? Now the tag is going to be fixed size, kind of like a hash function. It's not going to depend on the message itself. It will always be whatever it is. Let's call it 128 bits. So your tag will always be 128 bits, okay? So it doesn't matter if your message is the full contents of your hard drive, or if it's just a short, you know, one byte, it doesn't matter. You always have a tag that's exactly the same size. I'm not even going to put size in because we'll circle back to it. It's kind of a complicated discussion. How long is it? Okay. So what Alice will do is she'll send M and A. There's no encryption, so MACs have nothing to do with encryption, nothing to do with integrity, okay? Later, we'll talk about combining them. That's naturally what we'd like to do is we would like to both encrypt the message and tag it as well. And then you can't read it or write to it. You can't change it or read it, okay? But for now, we're just in the world where we're only considering this in isolation, okay? So we're going to send M, no encryption. Okay, and Bob needs to verify whether this tag is correct. Is it the right tag for M?
Okay, so he needs a kind of verify function that's going to return true or false. It's going to take the message, it's going to take the tag and his key, and then he'll be able to verify it itself. How does this function work? So it's not that fancy. All Bob does is he actually recomputes the tag on the message. So he's just like, okay, if this was the message, then if I computed the tag on it, I would get this particular value of A, and is that the same value of A that was sent? Okay. So there's nothing fancy about verify. He just redoes what Alice did and makes sure that he gets the same answer, then he's happy. Okay. And so it's either true or false, depending on it. Okay. Questions about the setup? Okay, there's two ways to build a Mac. Well, there's lots of ways of building them, but there's two ways that are common. There's one that uses block ciphers. It's called CBC Mac mode. I've taught it in the past, but today I'm just feeling like skipping it. No one really uses it because it's insecure. It's not always insecure. You can make some assumptions under which it's secure. But basically, you have to know what the length of the message is. If you lose control of the length of the message, then it's not secure. And there have been some like really high-profile cases of websites that have gone really, really wrong because they tried to use CBC Mac. The reason that people use it is because they're like, we have a block cipher lying around anyway. We already have AES. So since we have AES, then we might as well go ahead and use it. Okay. The other way of doing it is with a hash function. Okay, and this is the preferred method. Okay, now I just said the word AES, and I realized that I didn't actually show you AES, which is something I usually do before we transition to Mac. So let me back up with apologies, and I'll just sort of add it here. I don't need a lot of space for it. Okay, so let's go back to block ciphers, and let me just tell you a bit about them. I forget if I drew this chart out yet or not. So the very first block cipher was called DES. DES was invented in the 70s by IBM, and at that time, encryption was actually illegal, or exporting encryption was illegal, considered illegal. And so it had a really small key size. And then there was a smaller variant of it that had an even smaller key size that you were allowed to export. So this is all based in the US. Anyways, the history there is a little bit complicated. One thing that's interesting about DES is, so cryptographers came up with it in conjunction with IBM. And they wrote it down, and then they handed it over to the secret secrecy agency, the NSA of the United States. And the NSA was in charge of, you know, breaking crypto algorithms, and they said, oh, we don't like the way it looks. Why don't you change, you know, there's this thing called the nest box I'll show you in a second. They're like, we don't like the looks of that. Why don't you change it to this other value instead? But they didn't really give an explanation of why they did it, okay? And so that freaked a bunch of people out. They weren't sure if the NSA was trying to make it so that they could break it, but no one else could break it. No one really understood why they did the changes, but they did make the changes. They put the changes into the algorithm. And then a few years later, there were some cryptographers, and they developed this way of attacking block ciphers in general called differential cryptanalysis. And when they looked at the original design of DES, they found that the original design was vulnerable to this attack. but the changes that the NSA had made to it made it not vulnerable anymore. So it turned out that the NSA had invented this attack a few years before the academics caught up, and they actually had fixed the algorithm so it was better. Okay. Now, the NSA has done the exact opposite in recent times, where they've actually, at least it seems that they put backdoors into, there's one thing that you can do as your project, I think it's the last thing on the list, called ECDRGB, deterministic random byte generator. And anyways, there's a backdoor in that, but you can read all about that. So DES is not that strong. So it has a 56-bit key. Okay, and so we know that you need 112 at least. Okay, so 56 is not just sort of theoretically weak, it's actually practically weak. You can do 2 to the 256 operations today on a particular key. And then the export version, which was the non-illegal version, had 40 bits. Okay, so encryption was considered kind of like a military weapon. So if you sent an encryption algorithm from the United States to some other country, then it was kind of like mailing a grenade or like a bomb or something like that. That's what it was considered as, okay? But they said as long as it's 40 bits, then that's okay. You can export it. So that stuck around for a long time. It was like in the 90s when they finally got rid of that law and you could do strong crypto and export it and there would be no particular problem with it. So then what they said is, okay, 56 is too small. So what if we... Basically, what if we did DES and we did it like 3 times? So like we encrypted it under one key, then we took the output and encrypted it again under a new key, and then took that output and encrypted it under a new key, wouldn't we get effectively like a triple size key? And the nice thing is we wouldn't have to go change all the implementations of DES. We'd just be doing DES, which already exists. We just do it 3 times, okay? Now, it turns out that was a reasonable idea. There is an attack where... if you compose it 3 times, you don't get the full security. It's not like 3 times your key length. There's this attack, it's called meet in the middle, and it gives you basically a doubling instead of a tripling of your security parameter. So for complicated reasons, they're related to the birthday paradox. You can read about it if you're interested. But triple DES effectively only gives you 112 bits. And 112 bits is, technically it's okay today. So that's under NIST standards of 112. Probably why NIST picked 112 as the particular lower bound is because there was a very prominent algorithm that used it. Still, you shouldn't use it. If you're designing something from scratch, you should not use it. Okay, if you have something that you've been using since the 80s and it happens to use triple DES, you don't have to go run out and replace it. Okay, that's what this is saying. But if you are doing some new particular implementation, you shouldn't use triple DES, you should use AES. So AES is the newest version. It comes in 3 flavors, 128, 192, and 256. So you can choose whatever you want, and it's a good algorithm to use. AES was selected through a competition, just like in SHA-3. So NIST ran a competition. Lots of people submitted encryption ciphers that could become the AES. AES stands for the, is it American Encryption Standard? Or Advanced, sorry, Advanced Encryption Standard. And anyway, so then they whittled it down to 4, and there were 4 possible candidates. And all 4 of them are good designs. There was no problem with them that anyone's pointed out in the literature since. But they had slightly different properties. Some were fast in software, some in hardware, some in, you know, whatever. Some used more memory, less memory, more logic, more math, whatever the case may be. And so NIST went through all these, like, tests, and they decided that AES was the most versatile. It would work the best in all of the... Sorry, they decided that this cipher was called Rheindel. They decided that it was the best. It was the most versatile. So they said, okay, Rheindel wins. Rheindel is now AES. Okay, so AES and Rheindel are exactly the same thing. And this whole process took multiple years. So every year there would be papers that would be written on the candidates with attacks, or the people who made it would like change the algorithm. They could tweak it a bit to make it more secure against attacks. And so, yeah, it generated lots and lots of different research results, which is good for academics anyways. Okay, so how does AES work on the inside? So this is another one of those scenarios where, just like with SHA-3 or SHA or whatever I showed you, MD4, you don't have to memorize the details. I'm just showing it to you so that you know that it's not magic, okay? It does work. It's kind of complicated. The reason why it works exactly the way it works is something that's well beyond your understanding. It's beyond my own understanding, even after, you know, working in crypto for more than a decade. You can specialize in that particular issue if you want. So there's a little YouTube video that I like that just sort of explains what the algorithm looks like. So I'll just walk you through it. You can sort of, I'll give you a running commentary of what it looks like. But once again, it's more just for you to understand. Okay. So what's going to happen is you're going to take your message that you want to encrypt. And it's not going to be a full message. It's going to be one block. So a block might be 128, or it's always 128, actually. Okay. And what you're going to do is you're actually going to break it up into smaller chunks. And it helps to visualize the chunks kind of like a square. It helps you sort of see what's going on. Okay. So imagine this is your first couple bytes of your message, and then the second of your message block, third, fourth, fifth, all the way up to 16. Okay. And then you have your key. And so what you're going to do is on the side, there's going to be an algorithm that takes your key, which is considered a master key, and it's going to create 10 new keys from that one key, kind of like a pseudo-random number generator. It's just going to blow it up into 10 different keys. And you're going to use each of these 10 keys for each round of this function. That's a small detail. It doesn't really matter. You can just think of it as using the same key. Then AES itself only consists of four operations, okay? But like we saw with hash functions, you're going to do those operations over and over and over again, okay? So it's like the same way that basic crypto works. Why do we do it? Well, we like that design because you can attack reduced round versions of it. So you can try and break AES when you only go around the circle once or twice or three times or four times, and then that gives us a sense of how close we are to breaking it, instead of attacks just coming out of thin air, okay? It gives us a way to kind of ramp our attacks up to the full version, okay? So basically, you'll take your message, you'll XOR in a key, and then what you'll do is you'll go through these four operations once, twice, three times, four times, over and over and over, and then on the last round, you'll do just three operations instead of four for, once again, reasons that don't really matter. So this animation just sort of shows that. Okay. So what are these four operations? So the first one's called subbytes. And what it is just a lookup table. So you have this big lookup table, and it says, here's the value that you want to replace. So 19, you look it up, and you're like, okay, 1, 9 is here. And then whatever the table says, you replace it with D4. Okay? This table is public. Every AES uses it. It's the exact same table in all rounds of AES, okay? All it does is, you can think of it as a random mapping. So it maps a number into some other random number. Why does this table look the way it looks? Well, let's say you have two values that are the same. Like, say you had A0 and A1. When you pump them through this table, A0 and A1, even though they'll be side by side on the table, the output will be completely different, okay? So even though they start really close together, when you put them through the table, then they're going to end up really far apart, Okay, so that's the idea of this table, essentially. So that's called diffusion. So most block ciphers operate under these principles it's called confusion. Confusion and diffusion. So confusion is the S-box, and it basically spreads, maps values. In a non-linear way. So it's hard to write down equations that are going to reverse this process. The other thing I'll note is that this is reversible. So if you start with this, then you can find the value in this table. You just build the inverse table, and then you can transport it back to the original value. Okay? So that's important because decryption, remember, if we're going to decrypt, we need to undo. So all these transformations, we need to be able to undo them. Okay? So they're all reversible transactions. Okay, so you go through your state, you look up all the values, you replace it. That's fine. Then what you're going to do is you're basically just going to shift things around. So in shift rows, you kind of rotate this once, this one twice, this one three times. It just mixes everything up. Mixed columns does the same. It's kind of a column-wise thing. It's a little more complicated where you're multiplying in some constants, but you're basically shuffling things up row-wise and column-wise. Okay. So if you have a one-bit difference, let's say you start with a state and another state, and they're exactly the same. The whole grid's the same except for, say, one bit, the very first bit. First off, when you go through the S-box, that's going to get replaced with a completely different value. Then when you start shuffling it, that completely different value is going to end up in a different spot. Okay? Then you're going to do the lookup again, and then it's going to kind of ruin that value, and then you're going to shuffle it into a new spot, and so it's going to kind of spread throughout the entire state, whereas after a couple of rounds, even though these two states started off being almost the same, they're going to end up completely different. So that's what you want. Okay, then you'll actually add in your key. So this is the secret. Everything else is public. Everyone can go through the S-box and the shift rows and the mixed columns because it's just the same algorithm. Okay, but the key is the one thing that you don't know. So what you want to do if you want to break it is you're going to write down an equation where you go through a bunch of steps you know, and then these are all going to be unknown values because you don't know what the key is. Okay, and then you're going to want to solve the equation for the unknown, but it gets really, really complicated, so complicated that the equations are just astronomically huge that you would have to solve. So this just sort of shows you what the state looks like as it evolves over time. Okay, so once again, what's the big drawback or the big takeaway from this? It's just that it's complicated, but it's not magic, okay? So it is using basic operations like shuffling things around and XORs and things like that. Now it's just showing you what happens to the key. How do you expand the key into all these subkeys that you're going to use for every round? It basically does something similar to the actual encryption algorithm, but this key schedule we don't really care that much about. So you do confusion, which makes things nonlinear. You do diffusion, which is spreading the values around. So shift row, mixed column does this. And then you incorporate the key. Which is the secret. So once you incorporate the secret, then you lose track of the state. You no longer know what the state is because you don't know what the key is. Then you're going to mix the state up some more, but you don't even know what it is. And then you're going to add another secret in, and then you're going to mix it up some more and add another secret in. And so you're just going to lose track of the state. And like I say, if you try and write down equations to follow all of this, it's going to become too complicated too quickly, at least for something like AES. Okay, so like that's literally the level that we'll go into. We're not going to go into it much more, but it's just to show you, that when you look inside these things, they're not magic. Okay, any questions about that? No? Okay, so I'm not going to test you on the internals of AES, but this is what a block cipher happens to look like. what you should know is the actual modes of operation. Okay, let's take a 10-minute break. Then we'll come back to Max and how we design a map using hash functions. Okay, so the assignment was well done. I think the average was 8 out of 10. It was marked out of 10. We dropped part E. I'll tell you why when we get there. A lot of people were confused, though, during office hours. I think part of the problem is the setup was exactly the same as past assignments, so a lot of people went and tried to read last year's solution, even though it was asking something completely different, and then ended up confusing themselves. So the real key to this assignment, I would say, is just understanding what's being asked. And then once you know what's being asked, it shouldn't be that difficult of an assignment. So in part A, we basically have this hash function. Alice is trying to compute a solution to send it to Bob, or maybe vice versa, I forget. And what she's looking for is she's looking for an output of a hash function that's in a particular range of values. Okay. So remember, the output of a hash function is a number. Okay, so we can just think of it visually. Okay, the smallest number that the output of a hash could be is all zeros, all the way across. The largest number could be all ones. Okay, what is that in binary? Or if you convert it, that's going to be 2 to the 256, or 2 to the 256 minus 1. I'm just going to ignore the minuses ones. They don't really change things. A little easier. Okay, so basically you have a number between 0 and 2 to the 256. Okay, and what the question is asking is, okay, what if it's less? You basically want to hash with different values, and every time you hash with a different value, you get a completely different output. Okay, so you can think of it as choosing a number along this line at random. Okay, if you pick a number here, then you try again. Okay, then you're going to pick a number at random, then you're going to try again, and then eventually you're going to pick something in this region, and then you're good. Okay, that's what you're trying to do, is find a value that ends up in this region. So the question is, how many times do you have to try until you end up in that region? Okay. So the first thing we need to understand is, well, first off, what's just the probability of ending up in that region? Okay. So we have 2 to the 115 is the line. So we're basically saying, okay, what's the probability that we're here as opposed to over here? Okay. So 2 to the 215. Thank you. Okay. All right. So now if these numbers, like these 2 to the powers, confuse you, an easier way of thinking about it is just think of this as like 0, 100, and whatever, 17, okay? Let's, just for consistency, we'll make this 99. And there's actually 100 numbers. Okay, what's the probability that we land in the region if those are our numbers? So it's going to be 17 over 100, right? So 17% of the time, you're going to end up in that region. So it's the same thing here. We're basically saying this minus this divided by this minus this. Okay. So this region divided by the entire region is the probability that we end up in this particular region. So I'll just say the probability that we end up in this sort of dark region is going to be 2 to the 215 minus 0 over 2 to the 256 minus 0. Okay, and then that works out to 2 to the minus 41, or 1 over 2 to the 41. There's some different ways of thinking about this that will give you the same result, but that's the way I like it. Okay? Now we want to ask ourselves is, okay, basically you do an experiment, the probability that you win the experiment is 1 over 2 to the 41. That's a really small number, okay? So the chances that you win, like on your first attempt, is going to be almost zero. It's very close to zero, not quite zero. But if I play it two times, three times, four times, 100 times, 2 to the 50 times, whatever, at some point I'm going to actually get a good shot of winning this at least once, okay? So what's that number? How many times do I have to play this game until I win this particular thing? So what we can do is we can use the expected value equation that we used in class. So it tells us that anytime we have a random experiment where we do it a bunch of times and there's a probability of winning every time, the expected number of successes is going to be the number of attempts times the probability of success. Okay. So we can fill in these numbers as best as we can. What's the expected number of successes? Well, we want Alice to win this once. Once she wins it once, then she can send the email. Okay, so we'll make that equal to 1. How many attempts? Well, that's actually what we're trying to find. That's what the question is. Okay, so we'll give it a name, call it N. And if I do it just once, what's the probability that I win that one time that I do it? So that's the probability that we just derived. So if you solve for n, you'll get n equals 2 to the 41. Okay? So if you do this 2 to the 41 times, then you'll expect to win at least once. Okay, that's what that means. So that's an average case expected value. Okay, questions about that? Okay. Then part B says, instead of putting in the hard-coded number 2 to the 115, let's just call that a value. We'll call it Z. And so if we call it Z, then what's this equation? So instead of it being 2 to the 41, it's going to be 2 to the something to do with Z. Okay. So what we can do is we can just go back to the start. And this time, we'll use the same equations. We'll just leave a Z in instead. So we can calculate the probability as 2 to the Z over 2 to the 256. And then we can calculate this to be 1 equals n times 2 to the z over 2 to the 256. And so we'll get n equals 2 to the 256 minus. Okay, questions about that? So we'll call this equation 1. Call this equation 2. This is equation 1. Okay, the next question, I forget what it says. I think it's how many times does Bob have to hash in order to verify it? So Bob he receives this message, so it has the email, it has his address, it has this not. He just says it once. He hashes it once, and then he sees, yep, when I hash that, it does give me an answer that's in this region. Therefore, I accept it as being true. Okay. So that's the whole idea here, is that Alice is going to do 2 to the 40 work. Okay, so that's a lot. You know, it's going to take her 10 minutes to do on her computer or whatever the case may be. The Bob only has to do it once, okay? So you're paying a cost to send an email, but in order to verify it, you don't have to pay the cost. If Bob had to redo the whole computation itself, then it'd be very expensive to receive email as well as to send it as well. Okay, the next one, I think, asks if you want to parameterize it to 2 equals, or you want the amount of work to be 2 to the 20, then what do you have to set Z to be in order to do it? So what we can do is we can take this equation here. Oh, it's equation 3. Okay, so we have equation 3 from down there. It says n equals 2 to the 256 minus z. Okay, what's n in this case? N is the amount of work that we have to do. If we want to set n to be a particular value, then we just set it to be the value we want. So in this case, the question's saying, well, what if n was 2 to the 20? Okay, then what would Z be? Okay, so we get 2 to the 20 equals 2 to the 256 minus Z, and take the logarithm base 2 on both sides. We get 20 equals 256 minus Z, and Z equals 236. Okay, part E, what I was going for is, I wanted to say, okay, if you find something in this region, it has a certain probability, and then what I was trying to do is to find the same region over here, and then basically say, as long as you're greater than this particular amount here, called T, and then I wanted so that the probabilities ended up being the same. I made a mistake, though, is when I gave you the particular value, I should have given you a different value than I did. So I gave you 2 to the 256 over 2 to the z, but I should have had 2 to the 256 minus 2 to the z. So anyways, the numbers ended up all kind of messy. You could actually solve part E. You would get a weird equation. It wasn't what I was going for. So we just decided to drop it because the questions were kind of all over the map. So there's no marks for part E. Okay, then part F asks, okay, what if you want to find two solutions instead of one? So what we can do is we can go back to, say, this equation. So we have 1 equals n times 2 to the z over 2 to the 256. Okay, now why is that 1 there? What's the 1 represent again?
Number of
successes. Okay, so here it's asking we want two successes instead of one, so we change that to a 2. And then when you solve for n, you get 2 times 2 to the 256 minus c, and so the work doubles, essentially. So if you want to find two solutions, it takes twice as long as finding one solution. So that's not an unexpected result. Another way of thinking about it is all the work that you put into finding your first solution doesn't help you find a second solution anymore. Okay, so it's like you find your first solution, then you just start again, and then go looking for a second solution. There's no overlap in terms of the amount. Okay, any questions about that? Okay, so the assignments were not marked by myself. They were marked by the TA. So if you have questions with your marking, you can email. He requested that you email him, and then he'll set up a time to meet with you. So I'll give you his email address. It's on the course website as well. Okay, and I'm really serious about that. If you come up after and are like, well, why is this got a mark taken off? I'm not going to answer. So go see him, don't see me. Okay, questions though? For? Yeah.
Why is it to be 215? I think it should be 240. Because you said the question is you must find a number smaller than the
final. Yeah, okay. So if you want to be strict, so I did say smaller, and I wasn't clear if that's less than or equal or less than, right? So if it's less than or equal, you can use 2 to the 115. If it's strictly less than, what's 1 less than 2 to the 215? So it's not 2 to the 1/4. That's actually half the size, right? Yeah, exactly. So it's 2 to the 115 minus 1.
So that bit should be 0, and that bit should be 120.
Nope. So that's not good. So it's easy to think that, right? But what's 2 to the 114? Remember, this is the number of times you multiply 2 by itself, right? So 2 to the 114 equals 2 times 2 times 2, 114 times, right?
I mean, it's the value is not the value.
Okay, first up, do you agree with this? 2 to the 114 equals 2 times itself, 114 times. Yeah? So 2 to the 115 equals 2 times itself, 115 times, right?
Yeah.
So 2 to the 15 equals 2 times 2 to the 114, right? Because you just added a 2 or multiplied another 2 in. Yeah? Okay. Then your question is, okay, what's less than 2 to the 115? So what's 1 less than 2 to the 115? Well, 2 to the 115, 2 to the 215, sorry, minus 1 is clearly 1 less. Yeah? But 2 to the 214 is half of 2 to the 115. Yeah? Think about it this way. What's 2 to the 4? 16. 2 to the 3 is 8. Right? It's half. It's but what you want is 15. So 15 is 2 to the 4 minus 1. Yeah. Anyways, these minus 1s don't make a difference. So just like this one's a minus 1, you can ignore it. But yeah, the mistake you made is very easy. It's very easy to get mixed up by exponentials. It's not an uneasy mistake to make. It is wrong. Okay, other questions? All right, so this thing still doesn't seem to be working, so I guess we'll just continue on the board. It's really annoying, but... Okay, so we were talking about maps. And we were talking about, okay, let's use a hash function to build a map. Okay? And so what we'll do is, let's play with this in a couple attempts. Okay, so for the first attempt, what we're going to do is let's just hash the message itself, see how that works, okay? So just to remind ourselves, what we want is okay, so we have this tag of a message that's equal to A. So what if we implement tag just as a hash itself? Okay. So we say A equals the hash of the message. What's wrong with that?
Let's hit again. Limit to the width of the message and the
Okay, so there's no key involved, there's no secret involved. This is a public function. So if the adversary wants to change the message, she'll see, she'll just compute a new message, and then she'll compute the hash of that new message. So we can't use a public function, okay? We have to use the secret somehow. So remember, Alice and Bob both hold the secret key. Okay, so we're going to try and involve the secret key somehow in what we're doing, and then that will help a lot. So what we can do is, we want to put the key somewhere. Where are we going to put it? Well, a hash function just has one input. So why don't we just put the key and the message into the hash function together? Okay. And we can do key, then message, message, then key. Those will be the two attempts. Let's do key message first and see where that gets us. Okay, so this means concatenation, this double bar. Just means you stick them together. By the way, I'll upload this even though I'm trying to upload this. Okay, does anyone spot an issue with this? It's a little hard to spot, but there is an issue. First off, what happens if we change? So we change the message to M prime. Now we have to calculate the hash of K and M prime. We don't know what K is, right? So that's a problem. So we're not going to be able to compute it. Could we get K out? Let's say I gave you both M and A. Remember, that's actually what goes across the wire. Why couldn't I just look at M and look at A and say what K is? Pre-image resistance. Okay, so the hash is a one-way function. So there's no way I can just look at A and pull K out. Okay. So that's good. So the hash is doing something for us. We want our max to be fixed size. So this is a fixed size. It doesn't matter how big message gets. A will always be 256 bits or whatever the output size of our hash function is. Okay. So this is really close to a Mac. We can't just look at it and compute what this value should be if we change M. Can't get K out. Is there anything we can do? Okay, how is that? Okay, so length extension is actually the right attack here. So what's a length extension? Well, what you do is you add something onto the message, and then you know what gets added onto the hash of the message, even though you don't know what's inside the hash itself. Okay? So let's think about this. So, well, in terms of length extension, what that means is we'd start with M, the original, and then we add some value on the end. I think in class we called it A, but since we're using A to be the output of our Mac, let's call it Z instead. Okay. So we want to change M into M prime, which is M with Z added onto the end of it. Okay, that's the value that we want to send across the wire. Can we create the hash value that goes along with that, even though we don't know what K is?
Yeah.
How?
Compute the hash.
We
take the hash and
compute. Okay. So we use it is the length extension. First off, the simple observation is that's actually the definition of the length extension attack, right? Is if you want to add Z onto the message, then you can compute the hash with it added on the end. Okay, and if you want to think about what it actually looks like, it looks like A run through the compression function. This is compression. Of A and Z, but it doesn't matter. This is a length extension. So when I showed you the length extension attack, everyone's like, well, what's it good for? You know, we can't see any applications of it. This is what it's good for. So for a long time, we thought this was okay to do with max. Then we found the length extension attack, and then all of a sudden, you can't do max this way, okay? Very simple way of doing max, okay? So there's a way to stick some value onto the end of both of these values, okay? You can add it onto the end of here, consistently add it onto the end of this value, even though you don't know what k is. No idea what k is. Okay. All right, so that doesn't work. That would be very simple. Now that we have SHA-3, and SHA-3 is not vulnerable to length extension attacks, there is some talk about going back to using this as max, just because it's so simple. Okay. But anyways, definitely with anything that has length extension, like SHA-256, you can't do this particular style of math. Okay, how could we solve it? Okay, we don't want to use encryption just because that's expensive. So just with hash functions. Well, what if we just reverse M and K? Think about it. Okay, is that better? So what happens? We can still do length extension. So we had M concatenated with Z, but now we have hash of MKZ. Okay? K's in the wrong spot, right? So what Bob will do is he'll come along and say, oh, so this is supposed to be the back of M concatenated with Z, let me check it. And he'll compute the hash of M, Z, K. But what you can really do with the length extension attack is get M, K, Z. So what you can compute is MKZ, but what you really want, what's going to pass the test, or Bob will say that that's true, is MZK. Okay. So all you've done is you've replaced the key. Because length extension allows you to add something at the end. What's at the end in this MAC? It's always the key. So by adding stuff to the end, what you're really doing is changing the key. Okay. You're changing it from the key that Bob actually has to some key that you make up. Right? But you don't know what Bob's key is, right? So the only way you could pass, like, you could pass off a message is by sticking the exact right value of the key on the end. But then once you know the key, then you can map anything in this. Does that make sense? Okay. So this one is fine in terms of length extension attack. Now, there's another reason we don't like this particular one that's kind of convoluted, so I'm not going to go into the nitty-gritty details, but I'll explain it just briefly.
Can't remember if I drew it up. Okay. To erase some of this.
Let's say that you were able to find a collision for a hash function. We know this is impossible. Hash functions are collision resistant. But let's just assume, for the sake of argument, that you could find a collision for a hash function. Okay? M1 and M2. So these things hash to the same value. Okay? What would happen if you sent M1 and M2 using this particular map? Some of it depends on how big M1 is and M2 is, but if we think of how a hash function works on the inside, we basically have a sort of compression function. It takes an IV, takes your first block, call that M1. Okay? Then it takes the output of it, it mixes it with the key. That's the second, we'll say the key is a second block. Okay, and we get some value out, we'll call it A. Okay, A1 for M1. Now, if we do it with M2, we get this value. Okay? Now, the first thing says these are collisions. So the hash of M1 and M2 are the same. What does that mean? Well, what it means is that the value on this wire, okay, and the value on this wire are the same, because that's the hash of M1, and this is the hash of M2. Okay? Once they're the same, you put them together with the key's the same, and you're going to end up with the same output. Okay? So these will be the same. I'll say one, I'll say two. Okay. So if you can find a collision on two messages, the max of them will be the same when you use this style of back where you put the key on the end. So even though you don't know what the key is, you still have no idea what it is. If you walked up to Alice and said, here's two messages, would you compute the MAC on them? You would end up with the same answer. Or more realistically, what you would do is you'd spend a lot of time finding a collision between M1 and M2, and then you'd be like, hey, Alice, can you MAC M1 for me? She would MAC it and then send it across the wire, and then you would replace it with M2, and it would be the same value. Okay? Now, we say that collisions, you can't find collisions in hash functions. Okay? So this isn't a problem in practice. If you can't find collisions, then you can't replace values. But as cryptographers, we know that, first off, we're very paranoid, okay? So any, like, sniff of an attack, we don't like. So if we can get away from this problem, it would be good. The second thing is that we know that collision resistance is the first thing to break in terms of hash functions, okay? So when hash functions get old, they tend to find collisions, and then a while later, you find free images. So free images are a lot harder to find than collisions. So what we would like, just for, you know, to sleep well at night, is, even though this is a perfectly secure construction, what if we could do better where we had a hash-based MAC that only required pre-image resistance? It didn't require both pre-image resistance and collision resistance. Then it would be a better hash function because collisions are easier to find. Okay, so that was the motivation for a fourth attempt, which is, can we do this in such a way that we only require PR, not CR? And just as a reminder, that's why it requires CR. Why does it require PR? What if PR broke, but it was still CR? Why does that not work as a hash function? So you just suck K out, right? You're given the hash of the message with K. If you can reverse that, then you can take it. Okay? So we require pre-image for that reason, and we also require collision resistance now because of this particular problem. Okay? So can we do a hash-based MAC that's based on hashes, it uses the key, not going to be vulnerable to length extension attacks, and finally tiny collisions that are going to help you break it. Okay, so that's kind of the laundry list, the new laundry list of things that we want. So it's based on hash, just hashes, nothing else. We have to use a key, otherwise that's why attempt one failed. It shouldn't be vulnerable to length extension attack, that's why attempt two failed. And it shouldn't be vulnerable to finding collisions, that's why attempt three didn't strictly fail, but we didn't like it. Okay. So there is a solution, it's called HMAC. Probably not something you would come up with on your own, so I'll just write it down. And what we're going to do is we're actually going to nest two hash functions. So we're going to have an inner hash function and an outer hash function. Okay, so what we're going to do is we're going to take the hash of k, and then we're going to concatenate onto it the hash of k and m. So we'll refer to this as the inner hash, and we'll refer to this as the outer hash. Okay, the outer hash is effectively, it's k concatenated with the message, so that looks a lot like attempt two, right? Even though we erased it off the board. Okay, and the inner hash is k concatenated with the message, so that's exactly attempt two. So it's kind of like attempt two inside of attempt two. Okay, now why did attempt two not work? Remind me again. Okay, length extension, that was the problem with it. So why does this solve the length extension attack? Okay, let's say I want to do a length extension attack. What that means is I want to replace m with m concatenated with some value z. Where do I have to put the length extension itself, the extension, the inner or the outer? So the inner, right? Has to go in the inner hash function, okay? Can I stick it in the outer hash function? Sure,
yeah.
Right? No problem, okay? But it has to go on the inner hash function. Now, in order to do a length extension, it's true that you need to know the value that you're extending, right? Do you know the value that you're extending here? Do you know the value of the inner hash function? Why not? Because of the pre-image resistance of the outer hash function, okay? So you can't do a length extension on the inner without knowing the value, and you don't know the value of it because the outer has pre-image resistance, therefore it's not vulnerable to length. So you can't do length extension on the inner because it's protected by the pre-image resistance of the outer, okay? Now there's a little more to analyzing the security of this function We're not going to go through a full proof of why it's secure. But anyway, that gives you an idea of why A, length extension attacks don't work, and B, why we only need pre-image resistance. Okay, we don't need collision resistance as well. We just need that outer hash function to have pre-image resistance. Now, the big benefit of that is we could get away with, say you had a hash function like MD5 that's, what is the output, 128 or something like that. So it's not the full 256, which you would need for collision resistance. So if you have any legacy applications that still had one of these old hash functions, you could still use them today with this particular Mac, and it would be fine. So there's a lot of reasons why we don't want our Mac to actually resolve or to rely on collision resistance. Okay, there's a few other, there's what I just said is actually written in words in the notes, and I'll paste those in for you to review. Okay, the next thing I'll note is, okay, how big does A have to be in this particular case? Okay, so if it's 128, then that's like that NIST number. Why is that the magic number that we always look at? So it's bigger than 112 or 128. What does that number represent? Why?
Computationally infeasible.
Okay, so it's infeasible to do what with that number? To brute force it. Okay, that means you can't try every possible value. Okay. Now, what is the value in this that you actually want to try every possible value of? The key, right? If you try every possible value of the key, so if I give you A and M, and then you try every possible value of the key, when you find the right key, you'll get the same A for that M, then you'll know you have the right key, and then you can go forge any message you want. Okay. So it's clear that K has to be 112 bits. But let's go back to A. What about A? What goes wrong if A is 1 bit?
50% chance.
50% chance of what?
Predicting.
It's not quite right. You're on the right track. Just think about it. What 50% is a 50% chance at something? What is that something? Okay. So if you want to change M to another message, M prime, and you have no idea what the key is, you can't break the hash function. One thing you can always do is just guess, right? You can guess an A value, and maybe you're right. Okay, if you're right, then Bob will accept it and say that that was actually the message. Okay, so how big A is has to do with the probability of a random guess at A being correct. Okay, so you're probably not going to use a single bit because then you just get 0, 1, 50% of the chance you're right. Okay? It's also the case that in a lot of cases it might be, you know, we talk about Austin Bob like they're humans, they're usually computers, right? And so what you might be doing is you might be trying to send some value to prove that you're Alice. So you're going to send a message, and then you're going to MAC it. If you MAC it correctly, then the computer knows that you're Alice. Okay. Now imagine if you send it with the wrong MAC. What's it going to do? It's just going to drop the connection, right? It'll be like, okay, you weren't Alice. Who knows what happened? Maybe you were Alice and something got screwed up, or maybe you weren't Alice. I don't know. Okay. But then if you come back and reconnect, you can try it with another MAC value, right? Maybe it fails, maybe it doesn't. If it fails, it drops the connection. Then you can come back and try it with another value, okay? And because there's no human sitting there, they're not like, wow, this person's connected 100 times or 200 times. This is getting strange, right? It's just a computer, and it just answers yes or no, okay? So depending on when you deploy this scenario, what exactly is happening, it's going to determine how big you make A. Okay? So you want the chances of not only guessing A to be very small, but if Alice tries to connect with lots and lots of different values of A, you want to make sure that it's still small, even though she could try it a million times or a billion times. Okay? So in some applications, it might be you get one shot, and if you get it wrong, then we're going to like discontinue your account or something like that. Okay? So in very severe environments, the MAC can be really small. It might be 10 bits or 20 bits. Okay? Just enough so that probability of that one attempt is enough. Okay? In a scenario where you have like some box and you can hit it with as many values as you want, then you want it to be a big value. Okay? You want it to be more than the number of values that you could try. Internet servers are kind of in between, right? They have intrusion detection, and they're not going to sit there and let you connect to it a billion times or 10 billion times. Okay? It's going to give up after a certain amount of time. So in that case, you don't really need A to be, you want it to be kind of big, but not super big. It doesn't have to be 128 bits, it could be 40 bits, okay? So the answer to how big is sort of complicated, so it depends on deployment. But typically, 40 bits is sort of the number you'll see a lot in practice. Okay? So what that means is the probability that you just create a random value is 1 over 2 to the 40, okay? Or 2 to the minus 40. And that's a huge number, or a really small number, I should say. Okay? It would take a huge number of attempts to be able to win that game where you try things. And most systems, for other reasons, at the higher level in the protocol, they're going to throw you out long before you're able to exhaust that. Yeah. So it's just like the message size, basically. Yeah. So your point is why not just use 128 and then you don't have to worry about it. So that's a great answer. But in scenarios it's just like they just want small value. That's basically it. So sometimes these values are used as like authentication tokens. Like maybe they're in a cookie. And so you want to keep your cookies small for other reasons or things like that. So a lot of cookies, if by the way, if you're a web server, so let me do this as a formal example. Depends on deployment, typically 40 bits. And how do you get 40 bits? Because your hash function, remember, is spitting at 256 bits. You just truncate it. Okay, so you just take the first 40 bits and the last 40 bits. Okay, let me give you one application that's not really a crypto application, just because it occurred to me. Okay, so you're Alice, you're going to Gmail, you want to log in, and so you go to Gmail and it says enter your username, password, so that's great. So you put your username, password in. And the Gmail server is going to check, I'll just put UP, and let's say it's correct. Okay, so it's going to be like, great, that is your username and password. Okay, so we're going to let you in. Okay, so what they'll do is they'll send you back your inbox. Okay, now let's say you click on the first message of the inbox. We have a big problem because how does Gmail know you're the same person that just logged in? Right, how do they know that when you click that link, right, so they send you back the inbox, and then you're going to click message one, how do they know that the person, because all they see is they see this come, and then there's 10 million other users that are connected to it. A lot of them are going to have the same IP address because you're on Concordia's network and it's all coming from Concordia. And then they see someone ask for message one. How do they know it's the same person? How do they know it's not me on your network, you know, trying, seeing that you logged into Gmail and then being like, okay, give me the first message, right? How do they know that you're the same person? Not phishing. Okay, so what they'll do is when they pass it down, they're going to set a value on your computer. Okay, and it's called a cookie. Okay, and so what will happen is in your browser, you're going to have a list of cookies, sometimes called a cookie jar. It's basically going to say, okay, Gmail set this value for a cookie. And then every time you go to any Gmail URL, your browser will go through its cookie jar. It'll say, you're visiting Gmail, so you're asking for this message. It's at gmail.com. Do I have any cookies that belong to Gmail? So it goes through the list, and it says, oh, yeah, I have this one. So then what it will do is it will include it as a header to this message. So it'll send this cookie along. And same with the next transaction and the next transaction. Okay. Now, if you click sign out, then Gmail may say, it may erase your cookie, or it may get your browser. You can erase your cookies within your browsers. There's different ways of doing it, okay? So what Gmail will do is they'll update their database in the background. So they'll be like, here's the user, here's their password or hash of their password, and here's the cookie that we assigned to them. Their session ID, it's called, okay? So every time you come back with this cookie, it's kind of like you're submitting a password that proves who you are, okay? Now, instead of them having username, password, cookie for a million users, what they could do instead is they could set the cookie to be the MAC with under some K of your username, say. Okay? Now they don't have to remember that cookie value. What happens is you come along and you say, I'm pulpspy@gmail.com, this is my cookie. They say, great, they MAC PulpSpy under their key, which only they know, and if it comes out to be the cookie value, then they know it was the cookie value they gave you, as opposed to a cookie value that you're impersonating someone else with. Okay. So in that case, it basically cuts down their database. They don't have to store a unique cookie for every user. They just have to store one value, which is a key. Okay. So anyways, that's another application of Max. We're out of time now. So I'll see you all next week. Thanks.